Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Pakistani Taliban sent a grim message to Pakistan and especially its military leadership yesterday by striking at what most people care about most, their children. More than 140 people, mostly children, have died so far as the result of the attack on a school associated with the Pakistani military. This comes after the army began a campaign in June pushing deep into Taliban territory, and this, said the Taliban, is the price you pay. Meanwhile, American boots will soon be marching out of neighboring Afghanistan, a welcome development to most Americans, perhaps, but leaving a power vacuum. This hour, On Point, the Pakistan school attack, what it means, and what comes next. You can join us on air or online. Do you think yesterday's school attack will become Pakistan's 9/11, seared into its national consciousness and changing its citizens' view of the world? Or will it become just another chapter in the long-running battle to create a civil society there? The Taliban are to blame for the attack, but who's to blame for the Taliban? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a number of voices to offer their analyses of these recent events, but we want to start first in Peshawar, Pakistan, with Taha Siddiqui, who has been reporting on the attack for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Taha. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I do want to mention there will be a brief delay as we continue our conversation with Taha because of the lines that we are using. So, Taha, can you just give us a sense of the mood there? We understand that 3 days of national mourning have been declared. What's it like?
Well, I've been reporting since today morning in Peshawar city. The mood here is extremely solemn. There is, as you mentioned, a three-day mourning, because of which all schools, offices, and markets were closed in the city. Driving around the city, going from one funeral to another, one burial to another, everything is deserted. The streets look deserted. Peshawar is a very small city, very populated city, but it seems like nobody is out on the roads today. Every place that we have visited, there is a lot of mourning that is happening in different parts of the city, to the extent that even from one neighborhood to another, there is there are dead bodies being brought to the families. We went to one neighborhood where almost every other household in that particular neighborhood had somebody who they had lost. So the whole city is mourning. Even at the site of the location, there's a school where this has happened, the Army Public School. We visited that earlier in the day. There were some candle vigils that happened. Some civil society activists had come over there to sort of express solidarity with the school victims. But overall, the city is quite mournful and appears to be very deserted as this 2 to 3 day mourning period goes on right now in the city.
I have to tell you that this news is also a major story in the U.S., and the details seem quite horrific. I just want to play a short clip from an interview that was interpreted by the BBC, where a student described what happened when these gunmen came into his classroom, and here that is.
Mm-hmm. Amir had just finished a chemistry exam. He was sitting in the lab when the firing started. He said gunmen came in and opened fire on the students. He says they killed a two-year-old who just happened to be there.
You know, as I said, this is a major story here in the U.S. Many Americans still think of the attack on Malala Yousafzai, who just recently received her Nobel Peace Prize. Of course, she's a young schoolgirl who was shot for her decision to continue to stand up for education for girls. You know, there have been many other attacks on schools, but do you have a sense that this one is different somehow, that this is affecting people in a different way?
Definitely. The last attacks that have happened, there have been over 1,000 schools that have been bombed in the last 10 years in Peshawar area, around about in the KP province and in the tribal belt. But those bombings have usually been the ones that have happened in the middle of the night, with no students inside. The students are not targeted particularly. Some teachers have been targeted. As you mentioned, Malala Yousafzai was targeted back in 2012. But this is the time around, the way they have carried out this attack, the brutality of it is never seen before. The eyewitnesses I spoke to, I was at the hospital earlier today. I spoke to some students who are injured, who are receiving right now treatment and who were injured. According to them, they said that these attackers went from one classroom to another, spraying bullets at students which were on their desks studying or giving. There was an exam also going on in some of the classrooms. So the way this has happened, it is never seen before. But at the same time, there's a statement that we have seen from the Taliban. They are still justifying this attack. They're saying that this was an army public school. According to them, the most of the children who were studying there belonged to the army family, which is not true. There were actually majority of the children who were studying at the school were civilians. But they think that this is a way that they're taking revenge from the army officials and their children and their families, and saying that because of the fact that the army has been there's this operation which was started earlier in June, which has been targeting them. So they're saying that this is their way of getting back at the army. But at the same time, the overall unity that we're seeing and the public opinion that we're seeing rallying behind the government for support of action against militancy, that is also unprecedented. Although at the same time, I like to point out here one thing, that we've seen this sort of unity in the message earlier also. But then this unity usually dissipates in a few days after, because of the fact that overall in the Pakistani population, there is a lot of sympathy for religious extremism, and many a times religious extremism is justified because they justify it through the fact that the Americans are here in the neighborhood in Afghanistan, and they're occupying the Afghanistan territory, so this is a reactionary force. Even to the extent that I was at a funeral today, and I was talking to some of the relatives of the people who have been killed, a 16-year-old child who has been killed, and instead of blaming the Taliban, he kept saying this is the fault of our policymakers for allying with the United States, and that is why they should separate this alliance, and they should have done this long time ago, and we would have not seen our children dying. So there is this the unity is there, the outrage is there, but how long it will last is a big question mark, because we've seen earlier in similar instances when such big attacks happened that the public opinion dwindled after a while.
All right. Taha Siddiqui is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor who's been reporting on the recent attacks in Peshawar, and he spoke with us from Peshawar, Pakistan. Taha, thank you so much for speaking with us. Well, joining us now from Islamabad is Adil Najam. He is Dean of the Pardeez School of Global Studies at Boston University and former Vice Chancellor of the Lahore University of Management Sciences in Lahore, Pakistan. Adil, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Could you pick up where Taha just left off? He was saying that, you know, on the one hand, it seems to be an unprecedented reaction in that many people, you know, are disgusted by this, that the brutality of it is so shocking that many people are responding to that, but that there are still people blaming, you know, the government for what it perceives as too much closeness to the U.S. What do you see? I understand that you've just emerged from a meeting of powerful political figures. Where, in your view, is the anger directed toward about this?
I think one of the differences, and it you know, we'll find out as more unfolds, but one of the differences one is beginning to see is that even though some might blame the government for not doing enough, or some might blame outside forces, one new thing is that there is a unity, it seems, in really, really blaming the Taliban and really getting angry at the Taliban. there is a visceral anger in society. There's a visceral grief. Shops were closed today. You couldn't talk to anyone without seeing the grief. It was like the whole country was at a funeral. And that visceral grief I have not seen before. Over the years, one thought that we had been hardened. One thought that we had seen so much and so many of these happening that we'd kind of gotten used to it. And I think this was a reminder that, no, you don't get used to this. And this was at a scale that was so much bigger. The most important thing, I think, also is that this was about children. And what that did was that everyone could immediately identify and connect with it. This wasn't something that was directed at a military installation. This wasn't something that was directed at a particular part of the country away from where I live. So that connection one has not seen before. Now, whether the country actually uses that, this moment, to galvanize or not is something that I think is the challenge for the political class of Pakistan, which has been bickering all these years and in many ways continues to do that.
Adil, we need to take a short break in a moment. I'm going to ask if you would please stay with us for a few more minutes. But could you just tell us a little bit more? You used to run a school yourself in Lahore. Did you feel yourself to be under threat? And if so, why? I mean, do school leaders in general feel themselves to be under attack, or are there certain schools for certain reasons?
So educational institutions have been a target. I was the vice chancellor of a major university, a very liberal university in many ways, and therefore it was historically a target. Luckily, we were never attacked, but if you were in education, you saw yourself as a potential target. But this has increased in recent years much, much more. And I think there is a very dark underside to this, which connects what happens in Pakistan to what has happened, for example, in Nigeria, with the girls who were abducted who still haven't come back.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Taliban attack on a school in Peshawar, Pakistan. We're talking about the national and international revulsion to this attack. And also we're talking about what should come next. You can join the conversation. Where do you think this is headed? Where do you think Pakistan is headed? What should the U.S. posture toward the country be at this point? We've been speaking with Adil Najm. He's dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University, former vice chancellor of the Lahore University of Management Science in Lahore, Pakistan, and we caught up with him in Islamabad, where, as you know, we mentioned that you, ironically perhaps, were at a meeting of a number of, you know, important political figures. That's why you were there, to talk about, I think, one of the subjects, as I understand it, was the radicalization of youth. What were some of the things that people said about this? What were some of their insights?
The meeting was, we are preparing with the United Nations a national report on the future of youth in Pakistan. So it couldn't have been more ironic. It couldn't have been more pertinent. And of course, that future relates to both education, but also to issues of radicalization, to issues of security, and so on and so forth. And the mood again was really palpably, like, you know, there was not just a grief, there was not just a sadness, but there was also an anger in the room, and these were, you know, politicians and academics and so on and so forth, that I think was new, that I think was different from before. And I hope again that the country can somehow muster to use that to make the societal change that is needed. In some ways, you know, one felt that maybe the country was getting used to a certain level of violence. And what this incident has done is that the sort of barbarism of it was so high that it has kind of shaken the country really to its core.
Finally, Adil, before we let you go, and thank you for taking the time to speak with us, there is, I don't want to again pick up where Taha left off. Taha Siddiqui, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, spoke with us earlier, and he said that there have been these moments of national unity before, but then it's dissipated as people kind of returned to their factions. In fact, you said you're still seeing, you're not seeing the apologists that you had been seeing in, you know, previous incidents, but you are seeing people kind of blame U.S. policy as opposed to the Taliban for these attacks. And I just wanted to ask if you see signs of that, or do you see kind of people galvanizing around a particular response? I do note that the government has reinstated its previous moratorium on the death penalty and says that sending a signal that the death penalty will be considered an appropriate response to this. Do you see civil society, at least, do you see the leadership galvanizing around a particular direction here?
Too early to say. Too early to say. The bad news is that the domestic politics of the country right now is in a mess. Leadership, both in the opposition and in government, are really at loggerheads, trying to sort of, you know, the politics is at a mess. The good news is that for the first time in many, many years, it seems that the military has been taking fighting extremism more seriously, which is partly why this incident happened. Now, I think part of the answer will depend not only on two things. It will depend partly on how society reacts and whether this anger of this moment can actually be sustained into really narrowing the space for extremism and violence. And the second, equally and maybe even more important, is whether the military, in fact, makes its own campaign against terrorism much more focused, much more deep, and sort of does it in a way that it hasn't done before. I think the signs of the latter are fairly positive. The negative thing, as I said, is that the domestic politics of the country is in disarray, and whether the politicians can come around together and leave aside their more petty differences and use this moment as a moment of national unity, that is what's going to determine it.
Adil Najm is Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. We caught up with him in Islamabad. Dean Najm, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We go now to Tunisia to speak with Carlotta Gall, the Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. She covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for 12 years. She's now North Africa Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Her book is called The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Carlotta Gall, welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Hi, Michelle.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Daniel Markey, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a former member of the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff from 2003 to 2007, where he was responsible for South Asia. He is author of No Exit from Pakistan, America's Tortured Relationship with Islamabad. And what a book title for our conversation today. Daniel Markey, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Michelle.
So, Carlotta Gall, a lot of people are writing to us right now to say that the government of Pakistan is in effect reaping what it sowed with the Taliban, that basically it or its military created this situation. Can you help us understand that?
Yes, it sounds crazy, but I think that's really what has happened. They have, for 30 years, run a policy of training and giving sanctuary to mujahideen or freedom fighters in their view, but they're basically militants who are used to work doing an insurgency, whether for Kashmir, the disputed territory of Kashmir, or Afghanistan. And they've also trained and given sanctuary to a lot of foreign fighters. So over the years, these groups have come to become very powerful, extremely radical. And they've radicalized the population of Pakistan where they've been, especially in the tribal areas. And now some of them are out of control and want to fight the Pakistani state, which they see as not to their liking. So you've got a phenomenon like the Taliban was in Afghanistan, where they actually want to take power and they want to run their own Islamic caliphate or emirate. And so they've become a threat to the Pakistani state. The thesis, though, that I always also try and explain is that Pakistan has known this all along. They know they've lost some control of some, that they've tolerated it and tried to engineer all that energy and that destructive violence outside. So they've tried to tell them, go and fight the Americans in Afghanistan or go and liberate Kashmir. And they've not actually tried to stop this violent insurgency. And now they are reaping the results of that, because these groups got so powerful. Finally, Pakistan this year decided to move against North Waziristan, which was really the hub of a lot of these groups. And this is the reaction from that. It's been a pretty brutal campaign for 6 months since June. They've been doing a lot of bombardment with jets and with artillery, and a lot of people have been killed, civilians as well. A million people have been displaced. So there's a lot of anger in that region, and I've even seen it. I've talked to some of the displaced people. Even the civilians are angry with the military. So, of course, this is what you get. This is the militants retaliating in actually a fairly typical way. I've seen it before in Chechnya as well as in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that when they're pushed to their limits, when they've suffered a lot of casualties, militants often hit the softest target they can find, and especially they want women and children to suffer like they've seen their own women and children suffer. So it's I think the Pakistani military had this coming.
That's a very strong statement. You're saying, and what do you mean by that? Do you mean, you don't mean that morally, or do you mean that they should have anticipated
all the time,
this?
Yeah, well, they should have anticipated, and of course they do, and they guard their own, you know, bases and headquarters very strongly. So they probably thought a school was not a target, but they've had soft targets attacked before. They've had cadets killed. They've had, mosques, people attacking a mosque where all the military prayed in Rawalpindi. So they should have guarded this school much better. But that's always difficult. To foresee these attacks. I accept that. But where I say they had it coming was for 12 years I was reporting this since 9/11. And we knew these groups were in the northern tribal areas and were dangerous and were recruiting more and getting more and more radical. And for all those years, the Pakistani military did not go against them. And then it became so bad that when they did move against them, they've got a real fight on their hands, and they're nowhere near finished. And that's why I say they had it coming. They've also, meddled, I think, extremely badly. They've allowed certain groups to continue operating, and there are some still Al Qaeda groups that they've still got there. Ayman al Zawahiri is still there. The Taliban leader is still in Pakistan at large. So they really haven't tackled this properly, and this is why it's become so bad.
Let me get Daniel Markey into this conversation. But Mr. Markey, let me just briefly, though, play a short bit of sound from a press conference yesterday with Pakistan's President Nawaz Sharif, where he called the attack a national tragedy. He said that it was a cowardly act. We're going to hear him first in Pashto, and then we're going to hear the interpretation by the BBC, and here it is.
No one should be in any doubt. This struggle, this war will continue. The government started the anti-terrorist operation in conjunction with the army. It's now showing results. And it'll continue until terrorism is rooted out from this land.
I'd like to get just, Daniel Markey, at first I'd just like to get your assessment of the situation. I mean, you've heard all of our guests previously, and our Carlotta Gall is, arguing that in effect the government's reaping what it sowed here either. And I'm not quite sure, and I'd like her to at some point clarify whether you think this is ambivalence, the government's response has been reflective of ambivalence or incompetence or perhaps some cultural sympathy toward these elements. So, Daniel Markey, what's your assessment of this?
I think Carlotta's basically got it right. The Pakistani military has been guilty of nearly all of those things, certainly a degree of incompetence, definitely negligence, and then in a more worrisome way, an active connivance with various militant organizations that have basically directed their fight against NATO forces in Afghanistan, Afghan forces, Afghan civilians. That is, so they've provided safe haven to the Afghan Taliban. And even as all of this fight in North Waziristan has been going on over the past 6 months, and the Pakistani state, both civilians and military, have made it very clear that they say they do not distinguish between so-called good Taliban and bad Taliban, and even that they're going after now the Haqqani network that for so long the U.S. government has believed that the Pakistanis have not been going after, that they've been looking the other way. Even as all that has been going on, in the other part of Pakistan, in Lahore, closer to the Indian border, you've had the leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the other well-known international terrorist organization that's based in Pakistan that has repeatedly attacked in India, including in that horrible attack over Thanksgiving weekend years ago in Mumbai, killing 166 people. That leader has been speaking publicly to crowds in Lahore. And so when Carlotta suggests that the Pakistanis had it coming to them, of course, nobody can deserve the killing of this, you know, this kind of a massacre. Nobody can possibly deserve that. That's not the point. The point is simply that these are foreseeable consequences of a strategy that the Pakistani state has pursued knowingly over well over a decade. And well past the point that many of us on the outside believed that it was even remotely strategically useful to them. And despite the fact that the Pakistanis face a much more powerful Indian adversary on one side and an unstable Afghanistan on the other, there have been other strategies that they could pursue, including more cooperative ones with the United States, that they've simply chosen again and again not to do. And so that's how we get to this point.
I want to talk more about the U.S. role in a minute, and we're going to take a short break in just a minute, but I'd like to take one call before we do. Prasad, am I pronouncing your name properly?
Prasad? Yeah, you got my name, Michelle.
Calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michelle. Two comments very quickly. First is, on behalf of all of the Indians, we express our condolences to our fellow brethren in Pakistan. The second thing is, most of these issues have come because of the Pakistani military taking a unilateral approach to terrorism. And I wanted to hear what, you know, the Pakistani political machinery may talk a lot of things, but finally it is the military that can actually deserve or deliver these results. And they have not shown much of a change in their mentality to this. So I wanted to hear what your guests had to say about that. Thank you. And I'll take the answer of the call.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Carlotta Gall, do you want to answer that? I mean, Prasad is suggesting that the military is the real power here.
Yes, I think that's correct. What we've seen is the military always undermines the civilian governments. And what we've seen here is they've actually encouraged disputes among the civilian parties all this summer. And therefore demanded that the military control security and foreign policy. And therefore they decide the policy towards Afghanistan and towards India, and they decide security policy. And, you know, if you look through history, a military, when they rule, they often pursue, military campaigns, wars, which they then can't find the way to stop. And it usually is a civilian government that has to say, stop, this is the wrong strategy. And I think that's what we're all waiting for in Pakistan, for the civilian governments to get the strength to decide the way forward. Because I think the military is stuck in its thinking and can't seem to change and can't seem to revise a long-time strategy, which isn't working.
Just briefly, Carlotta, if you would, talk a little bit more about that strategy, particularly in Waziristan. You're saying that, I noticed in your reporting, you're saying that even some of the people in that region who support the intention say that the way the campaign is being carried out is excessively brutal, is heavy-handed. Talk a little bit more about that, that it's creating as many enemies as it is eliminating.
Well, it's incredibly difficult to fight an insurgency. We've seen it with America, but I've covered a lot of countries fighting insurgencies. You have to do it very skillfully and carefully. And interestingly, the Americans got it right towards the end. But Pakistan is using heavy artillery. They're bombarding from the air. We heard just this morning as well, after this terrible attack on the children, that they bombed in Khyber. Now, that's not going to resolve it.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the attack that killed more than 140 people at a school in Pakistan yesterday. Most of those were children. We're talking with Carlotta Gall, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Wrong Enemy. And also with us, Daniel Markey, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations, a former State Department official responsible for that region and author of No Exit from Pakistan. Carlotta Gall, before the break, we were talking about the way the effect of the way that the army's incursion to Taliban territory is being waged and what effect that's had. You know, I noted that the Taliban of Afghanistan, who are closely affiliated with the Pakistani counterparts, criticized this attack. They said that it's against the killing of women and children is against Islamic teaching. And a spokesperson for the Afghan terror group expressed condolences to the victims of Tuesday's attack. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, I think it's very cynical because they kill women and children the whole time in Afghanistan. The point about the Afghan Taliban is that they are, according to their mentors, who are the Pakistani military, they never do any attacks inside Pakistan. They've never supported that because that's the mother country, that's the sanctuary. They don't believe in disturbing the sanctuary. So they criticize that, but I mean, it's completely cynical. They just killed 60 men and children who at a volleyball match just last month in Afghanistan. So, I mean, they do the same. And in fact, there's an ongoing attack in a bank in Helmand right today now of innocent civilians who are just in the bank. You know, so I think it's completely cynical. But that's their policy, which is they criticize the Pakistani Taliban for attacking the mother country, Pakistan. That's why they've come out, I think, saying that.
As you would imagine, the Secretary of State for the United States, John Kerry, also condemned the attack, and the president, of course, did also in the strongest terms. Let me just play a short clip of what John Kerry had to say.
They sent their kids there with the hope and dreams of serving their country. Instead, today they are gone, wiped away by Taliban assassins who serve a dark and almost medieval vision. And the opposite of everything that those mothers and fathers wanted for their children.
Daniel Markey, beyond, you know, strong words, what do you think Washington's reaction will be and what do you think it should be?
Well, I don't think that Washington is going to fundamentally or even significantly alter its strategy either in Pakistan or in Afghanistan on the basis of this attack. The Obama administration is fairly committed, it seems, to its scheduled drawdown of forces in Afghanistan. It says that it wants to continue to cooperate with the Pakistani military in areas where we do see eye to eye. It is important to recognize that, you know, the Pakistani military does recognize the Pakistani Taliban are a threat, and they're a threat to Pakistan. They're also a threat to the wider region and world, given the opportunity they've struck at U.S. targets or helped others strike at U.S. targets in Afghanistan. They sent Faisal Shahzad back to New York City to try to blow up his SUV in the middle of Times Square. So this is an organization that is a common enemy to both the United States and Pakistan. And so the U.S. government will work with Pakistan where it can to try to help them go after this group. And I think that has included drone strikes against Pakistani Taliban targets in recent months. Aside from that, I think the U.S. government will continue to try to push the Pakistani state to recognize that all of these types of groups that share an ideology are ultimately very dangerous to Pakistan itself and to us, that we would prefer to cooperate with them on attacking these groups. If the Pakistanis don't do it themselves, then ultimately our relationship is probably going to fall back apart again as it was in the 1990s. And probably Pakistan will experience many more of these types of attacks in the future.
But looming, of course, over all of this is the fact that U.S. troops are pulling out of Afghanistan. How does that affect how this whole story is about to play out or is continuing to play out?
Well, from a Pakistani point of view, the U.S. drawdown is leaving a power vacuum on their border. And unfortunately, because they have not distanced themselves entirely from the Afghan Taliban, they will probably retreat back to a previous strategy of continuing to work with them, dealing with them, seeing them as a group that they can do business with, even if they're ideologically different. And pushing Pakistan's interests into Afghanistan, that will probably be destabilizing there. What we haven't seen over the past decade is the Pakistanis determining that the U.S. and international effort to build up a stronger new Afghanistan ruled from Kabul, democratic Afghanistan, they don't believe that that's likely to work. They think it's likely to falter. And they want to have a degree of influence, and the way that they've pursued that is through these proxies. And part of the reason they do that is because they're not convinced that they have any other option. The Pakistanis have so upset so many Afghans with their behavior there over the years, with their policies, that the Afghan Taliban are probably one of the few groups that have been willing to work closely with the Pakistanis. I would note that the Pakistani army chief is reportedly in Kabul now, or was just there speaking with the Afghans. And his message, I think, was twofold. One was the positive one, that they wanted to work with the new government of Ashraf Ghani. But the other side was, if the Afghans can't do more to tamp down the Pakistani Taliban, who have now found safe haven in Afghanistan, and the Pakistanis and their military will pursue them across the border. And now this kind of thing, it has the potential. There's a cooperative potential here, but there's also a potential that you see greater conflict between the state of Pakistan and the state of Afghanistan. So this could cut in two very different ways.
I'd like to take a call now. Dave is calling from Littleton, Massachusetts. I think he's got a perspective on this that he wants to ask about. Dave, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle, and thank you. I just wanted to say that if you look at American policy historically, it's inconsistent. We have people today who are saying we shouldn't be in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the Middle East for as long as we've been there. Meantime, we're still in Germany, in Korea, and in Japan. And I think what needs to change in order for us, because you had asked before one of the earlier breaks, what everything that's going on right now is going to mean for American policy. I think maybe if we change our policy, it will cause, we have to change our policy. You know, we have to realize that this is not going to be a 10 or a 15 year fix to get rid of the threat of terrorism.
Change it how? Dave, what do you see? What do you envision?
Well, our policy going back to when we were trying to root the Soviets out of Afghanistan didn't look at a long-term picture. It's just like the mission was, let's get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And then we left a vacuum in the area, much like the vacuum we left in Iraq that's causing us to send some more troops over there and to do strategic bombings of ISIS. We left a vacuum there. We haven't learned. But what we did in Europe is we stayed there for a long time. We're still there, and we're still a very positive force for keeping things stabilized there. But I think in the Middle East, and especially in Afghanistan, we've been in and out so much. Not only have our, for lack of a better word, our myopic plans caused caused people not to view us as a stable friend, but they've also left the power vacuum.
All right, Dave, let's let our guests respond to that. And I do have to say it's interesting because we're getting a lot of calls and emails debating this very point. A comment from our website takes the opposite view. Neil Blanchard says that having our military and the CIA in Afghanistan has done much more harm than good. By further destabilizing this area, we've only increased the amount of terrorism and drone attacks, or even worse, they're remote-controlled terror machines, and they do much more harm than good. So I'd like to hear each of you respond to that. Daniel, perhaps you want to start, and then Carlotta will ask you next. So, Daniel, Markey, what about that? I mean,
Yeah, there's certainly been this debate. It's been ongoing throughout the Bush years and now into the Obama administration about whether a far greater presence in Afghanistan would be able to bring about a lasting stability. And the early Obama administration, I think, reluctantly bought into that approach, surged U.S. forces over 100,000 for 18 months, and was ultimately dissatisfied with the idea that we would be there at such high levels for any longer than that, was unwilling to see Afghanistan as a place that was worth that kind of commitment, a very costly commitment both in terms of blood and U.S. taxpayer dollars, and committed itself to drawing down. We did see progress in Afghanistan. We have seen progress in Afghanistan. For those who would suggest that the past decade plus of our involvement there have done nothing, I think they're entirely off base. The problem is that you have to ask whether another 20 years, another 30 years, what is it that the American public would be willing to do for a relatively small landlocked country on the other side of the world, which doesn't have the kind of resource base or population that if you wanted to compare it to Germany after or Japan after the Second World War, you're kind of talking about apples and oranges here. Mm-hmm. So our expectations needed to be tempered. Our patience needed to be longer. Our resources that we would devote to this problem needed to be significantly greater. And all of this is happening in a world where there are so many other challenges calling for our attention across the Middle East and elsewhere that the Obama administration has decided to pull back. So I think that there's going to be frustration either way, that it was either too little too late or too much and a waste. You really can't win in this situation, and I think that's what we've been stuck with.
Carlotta Gall, would you like to add to this?
Well, I think there is one way to do it, and I think this is the way it's going, is I've seen on the ground the way to fight an insurgency is with the indigenous troops and the indigenous police, and Afghanistan's getting there. They need help still. They certainly need air power still because they don't have their own air force functioning yet, but they, above all, they need the money to pay their troops and the diplomatic support to show that their neighbors should not think of interfering. Because if Pakistan really does go ahead and invade or try and push the Taliban into controlling territory in Afghanistan, that's a breach of international law on a big scale. So I think they still definitely need American support, but I would say you don't have to do it with tens of thousands of troops. And I think that's the way it should go for all countries. Look, I'm in Tunisia, and they're helping Tunisia fight an insurgency, but very much from behind, training troops, and advising and giving, equipment and so on. So that I think that's the way to do it. And I think it should be long term. I mean, look how we support, Israel, Egypt, Jordan. All these countries have had decades of money to support them, to support the state so it can survive. And that's what Afghanistan needs, because I think the consequences are very dire. It would return to what it was in the 90s, which, all the militants would just love to come back and set up camps again. And you'll get more bin Ladens, doing that.
In the time that we have left, I just want to bring back one more voice, and this is a voice that has come to be known rather well in the U.S., that of Malala Yousafzai, the young woman who was nearly killed by the Taliban for advocating the right to go to school for girls, and has recently won the Nobel Peace Prize. And she, as you would imagine, is very, heartbroken over recent events, and this is what she had to say.
Now it is time that we unite, and I call upon the international community, leaders in Pakistan, all political parties and everyone, that we should stand up together and fight against terrorism, and we should make sure that every child gets safe and quality education.
Always tricky to ask people to predict, but I would like to ask each of you in the time that we have left briefly, if you can, do you hold out hope for this, that the civil society in Pakistan can assert itself and can unify around addressing people who are willing to take such action? And Carlotta, I'll start with you first, and I'll give Daniel Markey the last word.
It's progressing, but it's going to be slow. I agree. That's the only way. It's when all the politicians and the civil society and people stand up and are united and, in my view, get control of policy from the military and control their own military. That only then will things change. And that could take still years. But I think every step you do see a greater realization. The editorials today are better than they have been for years. So I think Pakistan will get there, but not quite yet.
Daniel Markey?
I think it's conceivable. I think that the Pakistani civilians absolutely do need to come together. But unfortunately, we've seen repeatedly with the current sitting government under Nawaz Sharif and even the predecessor government under the Pakistan People's Party government, a more kind of left of center or progressive government, the civilians haven't come together to really firmly mobilize and push back against extremism and violence throughout their country. I'd like to believe that this would be the way forward, but I have to believe also that the Pakistani military needs to come to the conclusion that its strategy is failing, that the incentive structure shift for the military itself, because otherwise I don't think it will give the civilian side the space, and I don't think the civilians are either organized enough or competent enough in many ways to seize that space on their own. Unless the military shifts its strategy, we're not likely to see change. And this is essential. I mean, this is a country – we talk about Pakistan in the context of Afghanistan, but this is a country of nearly 200 million people, nuclear armed. This is a problem that isn't going away probably for decades to come.
Daniel Markey is Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of No Exit from Pakistan. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Also with us, Carlotta Gall, North Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Carlotta Gall, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.